I'm full. I've already had breakfast and lunch. I had a 10-minute break between my plates, so I'm good. And I'm going to try to not take too long. I will try to keep it under 5 minutes, if even possible. But I know if you're like me, your blood's in your stomach right now, and I'll do my best to move right along. Today being Father's Day, what I've done over the last several years is to try to take one of our founding fathers that were so instrumental in basically getting our country started, and just kind of teach a little bit about one particular person. The reason I started doing that originally is because I was going through the Bible looking for good examples of fathers, and there really aren't any good examples of fathers. There's a lot of good examples of good people, great people in the Bible, but in the relationship between raising children, you don't see that much in the Bible. I guess the big exception to the rule would be the father to the prodigal son. There is a father who had the right heart and dealt with a difficult son, but yet it worked out good. And, of course, that is a picture Jesus told to show our Heavenly Father and how he puts up with us and continues to love us even when we're disobedient and we go off and do the wrong thing. But other than that story of the prodigal son, you don't really see even giants in the Bible like David. You know, he had all kind of problems with Absalom and Amnon and others. And other prophets and stuff. Rarely did a prophet have a son who turned out being a prophet in the Bible, because the sons they went off and did their own thing and just didn't follow the Lord and stuff. Anyway, so what I started doing was doing founding fathers. And I've enjoyed doing it, got to know more about them myself. Several years ago, Karen and I went to Williamsburg. How many people have been to Williamsburg? Just an idea. Okay, good bit. So you kind of know what it's like. It is a recreated what the town looked like back in the late 18th century. And every day in Williamsburg is like Groundhog Day. It's the same day over and over again. I don't know what day it is. It's sometime in 1775. I forget the actual date. But every day they start the day over again. And the characters that live in this town go about their daily duties as if it were that day. It's really a fascinating place to be, and you get to learn what life was like. They do things the way they did back then and all, and you see how they manage through life and stuff. And also, they're always talking about this problems that they're having with the King of England at the time and how they're being treated unfairly and this and that. And so I met George Washington. I met Thomas Jefferson. I met two different George Washingtons. One was the old young general, and one was the president. I met Patrick Henry. What a fascinating guy he was. And heard his speech, "Give me liberty or give me death." And it's just a really great educational time. If you haven't gone there, let me recommend it to you. But there was one guy I met that I had never heard of before. And I'll tell you his name, and you probably haven't heard of him either. His name is George Wythe. Anybody ever heard of the name George Wythe? He's not a household name. It's spelled W-Y-T-H-E, George Wythe. And I was more impressed with this guy than everybody else that I heard. And I've since studied his life and learned more about him. He's a very interesting guy. So George Wythe is the guy that I want to talk to you about today, one of our founding fathers. I like to call him the father to the fathers because he's a little bit older than all the other people, the Washingtons and Jeffersons and all. But I'm going to kind of go through his life briefly, and I've kind of put his age at every instance where something interesting happened to his life so you can kind of see his life progress and develop. So I'm just going to kind of walk you through his life. He was born in the year 1726, born in America. His mother came from the Quaker background, and one of the characteristics of the Quaker background is they're very quiet people. They don't they see virtue in silence, and so they don't pop off about a lot of things. So that's his nature as he grew up. His nature was to be basically a more of a quiet type of person. When he was 14 years old, he entered grammar school at what is now William and Mary, which is in Williamsburg. And he studied there for 2 years, so that would take him up to age 16, and then he decided he wanted to be a lawyer. So he enrolled in law school at age 16 and spent 2 years in law school, and then he decided to that he had enough book learning on it, so he went out and did an apprenticeship with his uncle for 2 more years, and then this takes him up to age 20. He comes back to Williamsburg, and what today we, as lawyers, we sit for the bar exam. Back then, you would interview and explain your knowledge of the law. So he went back at 20 years old and sat for an examination to be a lawyer, and he passed with flying colors. Very intelligent man. He was admitted to the bar in Virginia. So after being admitted, he moved back to his hometown, which was called Chesterfield, and he married a young lady by the name of Ann Lewis, but it was only a short-lived marriage because she contracted a fever like 7 months after they were married, and she died. So at 21 years old, he's already a widow, and he loved this woman very much, and he was very distraught. He couldn't even stand to be in the same town, so he decided to move back to Williamsburg. He then joined the law firm of his deceased wife's uncle and started practicing law in Williamsburg there. He had a chance at that point. Williamsburg was the place to be at that time. It was the capital. It was where everything was happening, basically almost in the entire United States. There was some stuff happening up in the Northeast too, but as far as the South area, Williamsburg was the place. So he became well ingrained in society there. So much so that the legislative branch there was called the House of Burgesses, which is the equivalent to today's legislature. Actually, it was the first legislature in the whole United States, state legislature. They selected him. They recognized his talents and wanted him to be their clerk. So he started doing that clerking for the House of Burgesses and met a lot of people in his law practice, too. One of the ladies that he met was a woman by the name of Martha Custis. You would know her as Martha Washington because he introduced her to, I don't know if he introduced her to her, but his good friend was George Washington. So those two got together and got married. So he's developing political relationships here too. When he gets to be 28 years old, he is popular enough in that town that the legislature appointed him to fill a vacant seat of somebody who had died in the legislature. So now he is an actual state legislator at 28 years old. Next year, 29, he meets another young lady named Elizabeth Taliaferro and marries her. And her father was a very wealthy nearby landowner and an architect, and he built them a house in Williamsburg, which was considered at the time to be the nicest house in Williamsburg. And it's a beautiful brick house. I think Joe has a picture of it up here. That's the house as it looks today. The house still stands. It is now part of the tour when you go to Williamsburg and you see the house of George Wythe. You can go in. They've restored it exactly the way it was. It's interesting. All his papers and stuff are still laying around the house. You can read his actual handwriting. Very interesting. I've been in that house. In fact, I saw George in the house. And it was an interesting time to see how he does it. He also, by the way, would wind up being a judge. And there is a courthouse. Those of you who have gone to Williamsburg, if you've sat in on one of the trials, he's the guy that's the judge in the trial, so if you know who he is. And there's some pictures of him up here, too, just to give you an idea. Rather smaller man, and the fellow who plays his part in Williamsburg looks a lot like him. I enjoyed talking to him and hearing his opinion. And it's amazing how well those people fit into their characters there. So they have this house, and they wind up living in this house that you saw for more than 30 years, ultimately until her death. But he's now a state legislator, loses his initial reelection bid because he was appointed to fill, but he had to be reelected. So by losing his election, the College of William and Mary saw an opportunity to hire him. So they hired him to be in the faculty at the College of William and Mary. Then we kind of jump to the age of 42, which year-wise it was in the year 1768. He then became mayor of Williamsburg. This was a big deal. You have to understand how important Williamsburg at the time is to the American culture. It was the center of American culture at that time. So that showed that he had endeared himself to the hearts of the people. Then a few years later, he traveled to Philadelphia to take his place as one of the Virginia delegates in the First Continental Congress. Understand, at this time, everything was still ruled by England, but the different colonies said, let's get together and have our own Continental Congress where we can make decisions for ourselves. This was a big, big deal. And so he was he was in the first group of Virginia delegates to that Continental Congress. It's the United States starting to come together and form, not as separate individual colonies, but now as a collective country. So he's in the process, part of this happening. It's about this time that it becomes obvious that there's going to be a war of separation between England and the United States. And George Wythe plays a huge part in this. He's part of the debate in this Continental Congress when they're trying to decide whether to separate from Britain or not. He asks his fellow delegates, in what character shall we be treated, as subjects of Great Britain or as rebels? Why should we be fond of calling ourselves dutiful subjects? We must declare ourselves to be a free people. So he was encouraging the other delegates to separate and form this new country. That is important because that was not his nature. He had tried time and time again to get along with the crown and with England. And time again, he had been disappointed with the actions of the English at the time and how overbearing they were and how unfair they were to the colonists. So he went through this journey of finally coming to the point of saying, this cannot be reconciled. We have to be separated. So later in that spring, he returned to the Virginia Convention to argue in favor of his friend Thomas Jefferson's plan of government for a free and independent Virginia. And then he returned to Congress and signed the Declaration of Independence in September 1776. So he's one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He then returned to Williamsburg in 1777, and he was elected Speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates. So now he is not only in the House of Burgesses, but he's the actual Speaker of the House. He assists Governor Patrick Henry of ensuring that Virginia would meet its obligations to the Continental Army's war efforts. And so during this time, war has actually broken out, and he remained at his home, the one you saw the picture of in Williamsburg, during the remainder of the war. This is important because this is a dangerous place to be, and he's risking his life by staying there in such a exposed and obvious area. So in the next year, he was appointed as a justice to the state's highest court, what they call the Chancery Court. At that time, it would be the equivalent today to the state Supreme Court. So you see him building up his resume of different things he's doing. In 1779, Thomas Jefferson became the governor of Virginia, and he and future President James Madison, who was the president of the William & Mary College, created the very first law school. Who did they want to be the professor at the very first law school? George Wythe. So they asked Mr. Wythe to do that, and he, of course, did it. He developed pretty much, Joseph, you'll be interested in this, the method of teaching law school, which still remains today. He developed the concept of what we call moot court, where you actually practice being in court as one of your classes. This came from George Wythe. At this point in his life, he's 53 years old. As he became the law professor, he finally, I believe, found his niche in life. He found out what his calling was, and that was to be a person who influences others. And this, indeed, he did. Some of his most famous or more famous law students over the years, one was a man by the name of Henry Clay. You may have heard of him. He would wind up being the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Littleton Tazewell, who would become Governor of Virginia and a United States Senator. James Monroe, who would be the fifth President of the United States. John Marshall, who wound up being the future Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. All of these people came through the classroom of George Wythe. And interestingly about this guy, not only did they come through the classroom, but they sat at his table, because he would take his students, not only teaching them, but he would take them home with him, and they would live with them in his house. So that way he could really interject himself into them. They would have discussions every night around the candlelight. He would talk to them about political things, about spiritual things, about ethical things. And he totally poured himself into these people who would in turn pour themselves into our country. Get to the year 1781. We're in the middle of the war. George Washington is heading north, heading to Yorktown, where he would ultimately be victorious in a battle. And he stopped and stayed with George and Elizabeth Wythe in their home in Williamsburg because they were such good friends. Following the war, Wythe spent much of his time working with others to convert the Confederation of States into a working United States government. He was a delegate to the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention in 1787. These are the guys who sat around and drafted up and signed the Constitution of the United States. He was a crucial part of that. He was in the process of doing this drafting when he got word that his wife was sick. This is the year 1787. He's now 64 years old, so he has to leave the Constitutional Convention, go home. Unfortunately, his wife dies, and they had been married, I think, about 30 years at the time. So he goes on, pours himself into his work. He represented Williamsburg in the Virginia Convention, which was called to ratify the U.S. Constitution. So the Constitution is sent around to all these colonies. They all have to okay it. And he is the person from Virginia who convinced his colleagues that, yeah, this is good. This is what we need for our country. We need this Constitution. Without him, it is not likely that Virginia would have ratified the Constitution. And if they didn't, we would never would have come together as a country. So important role that he played. Like I said, he was a judge in the equivalent of the Supreme Court. He used this opportunity to do something that was very unpopular at the time. Most of the wealthy landowners at this time had slaves, lots of slaves. And he inherited property from his parents in a town not far away. And about this time when he received his inheritance, he immediately set all of his slaves free. He believed freedom, quote, freedom is the birthright of every human being. And this is what's in our founding documents. But we weren't acting like it as large landowners. Slavery, you know, existed at that time and continued to exist for, another 100 years or so. But this is one of the first people who said slavery is wrong. We can't do this. And he put his money where his mouth was. He freed his slaves. But interestingly enough, the slaves that he freed, most of them didn't want to leave him. So he kept them on and paid them as he would anybody else. But they loved this man so much because of his kindness and his gentleness and his ability to see the value in every human being that they didn't want to leave him. Two particular slaves, one was named Michael Brown, one was named Lydia Broadnecks. I'm going to come back to these two because they play a very important role later on in life with him. But they would not leave him. Later on in life, he resigned from his role as law professor at William & Mary. And when he did that, the college, in appreciation for the time that he had served, gave him an honorary degree from the college, which he had not had before. So now he's 65 years old. And the courthouse that he's in moves from Williamsburg to Richmond. So he has to move to Richmond too. So he moves to Richmond with one of his students named William Munford. And he finds a place in Richmond that's walking distance from his house. And he continues to study law, to be a judge. And he has been studying Hebrew all this time because he's very interested in the Hebrew language. He wants to, when he reads his Bible, he wants to make sure that he's reading a good translation of the Bible. So he's learning Hebrew himself. He also was fluent in Greek, and he was also fluent in Latin. And he taught these to his students, too. So you're talking about a very intelligent man and a man that took his scriptures very seriously because he wanted to constantly be reading the original language in the scriptures. Age 70, he is one of the electors. You know about the Electoral College. They had the Electoral College back then. He was one of the electors. He casts his vote for his former student, Thomas Jefferson, in the year 1800 and again in the year 1804 to be president of the United States. And something else happens about this time. He's getting to be around 80 years old, and he doesn't have any children, and he takes into his house the grandson of his sister, whose name was also George With, and then Sweeney after that, George With Sweeney. So he takes in his namesake, and he treats this young man, who is, I think, 18 years old, like he's his own son. He takes care of him, tries to educate him and all. But this kid, this 18-year-old George With, he's a rotten guy. And he's known for gambling and carousing, and he even takes some of his great uncle's checks and forges his name to get money to cover gambling debts and things like that. So as George Sr. finds out what his nephew is doing, he changes his will. He had left everything to this grandnephew, and he said to himself, I can't trust him. So he took half of the estate and left it to one of his former slaves. So now his grandnephew is a half-heir, and this fellow I told you about earlier, Michael Brown, a former released slave, is a 50% holder in the estate. Well, it was a codicil that he added to the will. Well, young George With sees this codicil. He sees that he's been written out of half of the will. He gets very angry about it. So he decides he's going to do something about it. So he wants to kill the slave because if the slave's dead and he doesn't have any heirs, then he's back to 100% owner. So he knows the pattern in the house. He knows what the former slave, his routine was. So he goes into the kitchen, and the other slave, the former slave, Lydia Broadnecks, she's the cook. She says later on, I'd made a pot of coffee. I saw him pour himself a cup of coffee, and then he switched coffee pots on the stove. So she said, I just noticed it happening. So she later pours herself a cup of coffee from the new coffee pot and pours Michael Brown a cup of coffee and pours George Wythe a cup of coffee. It was a part of their evening routine, and serves it to him. Within minutes of drinking the coffee, George Wythe starts going into convulsions. He had been poisoned. His nephew had put arsenic in the coffee pot with the intention, apparently, of killing Michael Brown, the slave, maybe with the intention of killing his uncle also. We don't really know that. But Michael Brown, the slave, former slave, dies from the poisoning. George Wythe gets very sick. He dies, but he lives about 2 weeks in serious pain. During that two-week period, they figure out what happened. They figure out that the nephew had poisoned the coffee. So George Wythe writes a codicil to his will, eliminating his nephew from the will entirely so that he doesn't benefit from this act of treachery and murder. So he then still dies, though. He dies at 80 years of age in otherwise perfect health. This guy just had a good set of genes in him. He probably could have gone to 100 with no problem. But he died from poisoning. His nephew was arrested for his murder and for the murder of Michael Brown. They have a trial, but he's found not guilty in the trial. And the reason he's found not guilty is there was some medical examiners didn't do some basic tests. Even back then, they could tell if you were poisoned by arsenic. But they didn't do the test to make the determination to see if he was indeed poisoned by arsenic. So they didn't have a lot of evidence. They did have eyewitness testimony of Lydia Broadnax in the kitchen saying that she saw him switch the coffee pots. And she also saw him immediately after that throw a piece of paper into the fire, which would have been the container for the arsenic. But she was not allowed to testify at trial because she was black. And being black, she was not considered, just wasn't allowed to testify in trial. So even though they knew what had happened, in a court of law, they didn't have enough evidence to convict him. So he was found not guilty. He was told by his lawyer immediately after the pronouncement, you better get out of town because you may have been found not guilty, but you're not going to last long here. So he jumped on his horse, rode out of town, never came back to there. The only other historical knowledge we have of George Wythe, the younger Sweeney, was that he stole a horse in another nearby town. And after that, we don't even hear anything from the guy again. So now he has died, and people are remembering him in death. 4 days after his death, on June 10th, 1806, the Richmond Inquirer, which was the big newspaper at the time, wrote this: "Kings may require mausoleums to consecrate their memory. Saints may claim the privilege of canonization. But the venerable George Wythe needs no monument other than the service rendered to his country and the universal sorrow that the country sheds over his grave." I mentioned William Mulford earlier as his student that he went to live in Richmond with. Says this about, kind of a funny little thing about George Wythe. He said, old as he is, and he knew him from, you know, like 65 to 80. Old as he is, his habit is every morning, winter or summer. Now think about this, guys. They don't have hot water heaters back then. Winter and summer. To rise before the sun, go to the well in the yard, draw several buckets of water, and fill the reservoir for his shower bath. And then, drawing the cord, let the water fall over him in a glorious shower. Many a time I have heard him catching his breath and almost shouting with the shock. When he entered the breakfast room, his face would be in a glow and all his nerves were fully braced. So he'd dump a bucket of cold water on him every single morning. I don't know. I can't imagine doing that, but that's, the discipline that he had. He was highly regarded by all those who knew him. Thomas Jefferson wrote this about him: "No man ever left behind him a character more venerated than George Wythe. His virtue was of the purest tint, his integrity inflexible, and his justice exact. Of warm patriotism and devoted as he was to liberty, and the natural and equal rights of man. He might truly be called the Cato of his country. I don't know what Cato means, C-A-T-O. He was my faithful and beloved mentor in youth and my most affectionate friend through life. So Thomas Jefferson calls him his best friend. Fellow signer of the Constitution, or the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, thought George Wythe to be a profound lawyer and able politician. I have seldom known a man who possessed more modesty or more dove-like simplicity and gentleness of manner. Reverend Lee Massey called George Wythe the only honest lawyer I ever knew. So even back then, they must have had lawyer jokes. Well, his home is, like I said, still in Williamsburg. You could still go see it. It was considered to be the finest home in the town. In 1939, the house was bought and restored by whatever committee they have in Williamsburg to keep things historically accurate. You can go in there today and, like I said, see his optical viewer, which was his entertainment as... what do you call those things? Viewmaster. Thank you, Jeff. Of the time, I guess. A terrestrial globe. His bookcase still chock full of his books. Letters that he wrote to Thomas Jefferson and others available for inspection. Let me go through just really quickly the highlights of his life so you understand what this guy did and how he jammed it all into one lifetime. He was a Hebrew, Latin, and Greek scholar. He was a lawyer, state congressman, state Supreme Court justice, first law school professor in our country, and teacher of outstanding students such as James Monroe, John Marshall, who's one of the great thinkers on the Supreme Court, future Speaker of the House, Representative Henry Clay, representative of the First Continental Congress, a judge, tutor to George Washington, tutor to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So basically, he had influence on the first five presidents of the United States. Dear friend of Patrick Henry and Benjamin Franklin, he was the first signer of the Declaration of Independence from Virginia. And the interesting thing about that was he wasn't even present when the Declaration was first signed. He was absent. He came in later. But the other delegates from Virginia respected him so much that they left a gap on top of where the Virginia delegation signed so that he could sign on top. That's how well respected the guy was. Finally, he is the main man responsible for the ratification of the Constitution of the United States. So the question is, what was the secret to this man's success? How did he do it? One reason, I believe, is because he never sought glory for himself. This goes back to the teaching from his mother early on in life. He was kind of a behind-the-scenes guy. He was a Barnabas. He was the type of person that focused on encouraging others. But I think the main reason that he was so successful in life is that he recognized the gift that God gave him. And God gave him the gift of being a discipler of others. And he used it. He was a man of quiet faith. You haven't heard me talk a lot about any spiritual quotes that he said. Again, he was a quiet man, but he was indeed a man of deep faith regardless. And he poured that faith into others. So, if you think that your life maybe doesn't amount to much because you're not making a big splash in the water, neither did he. Neither did George Wythe. He never made a real big splash in the water. But boy, the impact he had on our country. I was telling Bob earlier, trying to rank his importance to the founding fathers, I'd have to put him in the top three easily. I think of George Washington, I think of Thomas Jefferson, and I think of George Wythe. Without him, I don't know if we could have gotten started as a country. But the thing that he did that was most important was not any individual event. It was how he poured his life into others. So I guess the practical application would be for us to always be looking to who we can pour our life into, because you just don't know. You don't know. Your name may disappear in obscurity, but just like the fellow that led Billy Graham to the Lord, I don't even know the guy's name. I've heard the story, but I can't even remember his name. But look what happened as a result of pouring his life into somebody else. And finally, George Wythe was a man who, although he never was able to be a biological father, we don't know why, it doesn't say, but despite the fact that he never was a father, I think he, more than any other, will always be known as the father to the fathers of our country. So, important man. Study him. Read a little bit about him. And he's just has led an encourage or a, such a valuable, important life. And I wanted to share with you about him. So, let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, as we close today and we are reminded of, once again, another one of our founding fathers who trusted in you and risked everything for our country. We are thankful for it. Lord, may we learn the lesson from George Wythe, and that is to be a discipler of others, Lord, that it doesn't really matter if our name becomes known well. What matters is pouring ourselves into the lives of others and just being able to duplicate ourselves. So help us to be mindful of that and remember it. We thank you for this great day. We thank you for all of our fathers that we've been blessed with, Lord. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.